Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the prophets of cancer right after this. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we seem to be among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies and multinational corporations, the lobbies, and the news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless. The institution designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power. The courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, our liberties, and our property. It's not the Congress, and it's not the political process. Now, did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant, nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to someone who is indifferent thereto? It is a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat, and it cannot be claimed by an attorney or a solicitor, and it's valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant and in person. So says U.S. versus Johnson. That's why I contend that we ought to listen more to our judges and pay less attention to our politicians and lawyers. Did you hear what that judge said in that statement? He said, your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or your solicitor. Your rights are claimed by you, the belligerent claimant, and in person. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. And while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order one. Or you can download it directly right off of our webpage. Just go to our webpage, georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com. Go to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package. All right, we've been talking about this thing of last time, the prophets of cancer. Now, showing you the interlocking bank or the boards of directors of these various banks and pharmaceutical companies. And they're all tied to the Rockefeller interests. And they're carefully concealed, and they're neatly hidden away in these trusts and foundations. Or in some cases, they're bantied about right out in front of our eyeballs in the form of the American Cancer Society or the Sloan Kettering Cancer Hospital. But the one thing that we've observed here is that the people that are involved in this cancer industry, pharmaceutical companies, the AMA, Sloan Kettering, Rockefeller, they're also tied to the banks and the institutions that support the profit or the profitability of cancer. I said it's just one big happy family. Let's take a look at these interlocking boards of directors. He goes on to say, this is only the board of managers of Memorial Sloan Kettering, the nation's preeminent cancer center. Each person on the board of managers shows many direct or indirect links with the Rockefeller interests. The center's board of overseers includes Mrs. Elmer Bobst, widow of the prominent drug manufacturer and reorganizer of the American Cancer Society, Dr. James B. Fisk, chairman of Bell Telephone Laboratories, director of America Cinemed, Corning, Equitable Life, John Simon of the Guggenheim Foundation, Chase Manhattan Bank, that's the Rockefeller Bank, board of governors at Harvard University and director of the Cabot Corporation, Richard M. Ferland, the chairman of the giant drug firm Squibb, director and general counsel of Olin Corporation, the huge munitions manufacturer, and director of American Express. Dr. Emanuel Rubin Piori, born in Wilno, Russia, head of the Special Weapons Group at the U.S. Navy from 1942 to 46, head of the Navy Electronics Bureau in 1948, director of research at IBM since 1956, professor at Rockefeller University, consultant to MIT and Harvard, director at Harvard University, and director of the Paul Revere Investors. Director of Sloan Kettering since 1976, and he received the Kaplan Award from Hebrew University. His wife, Nora Kahn, is a long-standing health analyst with the New York City Health Department since 1957, director of the Commonwealth Fund, Blue Cross Senior Fellow, United Hospital Fund, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation of the drug firm Johnson & Johnson, Pew Memorial Trust, Vera Foundation, Urban League, grantee from U.S. Public Health Service, James D. Robinson III, chairman of American Express, which has now incorporated both Kuhn Loeb Company and Lehman Brothers investment banking houses into Shearson Lehman Hutton. He was formerly with Morgan Guaranty Trust and is now director of Bristol Myers Drug Firm. Coca-Cola, Fireman's Fund Insurance, chairman of Memorial Sloan Kettering and Rockefeller University, James S. Rockefeller, director of Cranston Print Works, Lawrence Rockefeller, who is director of Reader's Digest with 18 million circulation, and National Geographic with 10 million circulation. What that means is that the influence that these two magazines have upon 28 million middle-class American homes every month. Reader's Digest, National Geographic. Dr. Ralph Moss, former public relations director of Memorial Sloan Kettering, noted that Reader's Digest is often a barometer of orthodox thinking on the cancer problem. The Rockefellers remain the most prominent contributors to Memorial Sloan Kettering. William Rockefeller is also an overseer. He's a partner of Shearson Sterling, lawyers for the Rockefeller interests. He's also director of Cranston Print Works and Oneida Limited, who serves with the Rockefeller Family Associates. He's chairman of National Aviation and Technology Corporation, CCI, ITAC, MITRE Corporation, Safe Trans Systems, and Quotron Systems. Arthur B. Tremann, T-R-E-M-A-N, Jr., managing director of Dillon Reed Investment Bankers for many years. Notice what's so blatant here is that these are interlocking boards of directors of the biggest institutions, magazines, businesses, multinational corporations, pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, departments of health, one big happy family, interlocking boards of directors. All of them lead back to the Rockefeller interests. The Rockefeller interests lead to the Rothschild interests. And this is, and then people say, well, are you one of those conspiracy theorists? And these boys and girls are the names of the people who are the conspirators. Now let's think about this for a minute. Let's suppose that you're a young person and you want to get on in the world. Let's suppose you want to get into journalism like Katie Couric or Brian Williams. So you go to college and you get a degree and you get into journalism and you approach CBS and say, gee, I'd like to have a job here. And like Katie Couric, you're bright, pretty. And somebody says, yeah, how would you like to have this job over here? Now, here's what we expect from you. You know, 60 Minutes was faced with this some years back when they wanted to do a piece on the tobacco industry. And the tobacco industry came to CBS and said, oh, no, we don't want you to do that. And by golly, CBS and 60 Minutes didn't put it on. Now, these are the movers and shakers, boys and girls. These are the people that make things happen. The President of the United States is way down the list, you know, when it comes to people that are making decisions. We think of our president as the guy that, you know, Harry Truman, the buck stops here. The truth of the matter is all these presidential candidates are specially groomed by the powers that be. That is, David Rockefeller's number one on the list. The 13 members of the Bank of International Settlements, those are the people who select the presidential candidates for Great Britain, the United States, France, all of the major Western industrialized nations. And not only do they select them, they select the candidates for both sides. And they finance the candidates for both sides. And when the election is over, their candidate always wins without fail. Then, when the powers that be go to the president and say, what we want is $765 billion in a bailout, they go to the Congress and say, you vote that in. You'll notice that the members of Congress on that first round of the bailout package voted it down. Nancy Pelosi said, tomorrow we'll have another vote, and tomorrow it'll pass. You know, they just sat those boys down and said, now let me tell you where it's happening. And tomorrow, here's the way you're going to vote. So any thought that you might have of writing a letter to Kit Bond or Nancy Pelosi or Dianne Feinstein and getting them to change their vote, you know, that's just a lot of wishful thinking. And when it comes time to reelect these people, they will be reelected. They'll be reelected. And that's because the powers that be finance those election campaigns. I know you may check off a dollar on your income tax return, and God love you for participating in the program, but when it's all said and done, yeah, $1 doesn't do it, but millions of dollars do, and these are the people that have the millions of dollars. And ultimately, those millions of dollars of campaign bribes that go through these lobbying firms in Washington and in your state capital, and the final analysis, it all comes out of your pockets. You're the guy that finances this every time you buy a pizza at Pizza Hut or you buy a car from General Motors. It doesn't make any difference. Now, there's more to the story. Not only do the boards of Memorial Sloan Kettering have direct ties to the Rockefellers, they are also closely linked with defense industries. They're linked with the CIA and chemical and drug firms. And it's not an accident that they serve on the board of directors of an institution whose recommendations on cancer treatment mean literally billions of dollars of profits. to those who are in the right position to take advantage of them. And you thought this was all charitable organizations just doing their thing to help people. The fact is, the Memorial Sloan Kettering and the American Cancer Society are the principal organizational functionaries, along with the American Medical Association, of the entire Rockefeller medical monopoly. In 1944, the American Cancer, or the American Society for the Control of Cancer, changed its name to American Cancer Society. It was then placed in the hands of two of the most notorious patent medicine hucksters in the United States, Albert Lasker and Elmer Bobst. Elmer Bobst. Remember that name? Let me back up a page here. The center's board of overseers includes Mrs. Elmer Bobst, widow of the prominent drug manufacturer and reorganizer of the American Cancer Society. And so now we turn the page and we find Albert Lasker and Elmer Bobst. Well, Albert Lasker was born in Freiburg, Germany in 1880. He died in 1952. He has been called the father of modern advertising. He focused on easily remembered slogans and constant repetition to drill his messages into the heads of the American people. Like other successful hucksters memorialized in these pages, he began his career as a journalist. He was brought to this country by his parents, who settled in Galveston, Texas. His father, Morris Lasker, became a representative for Rothschild banking interests and soon became the president of five banks in Texas. He lived in a luxurious mansion in Galveston. He was a prominent grain and cotton dealer, and because of extensive interests in West Texas, he became known as the godfather of the panhandle. He died in 1916, leaving his son Albert as his executor. Needing cash to expand his advertising business, Albert Lasker hurriedly sold the lands at a bargain price, which in 1916 was not very much. His business acumen failed him here, because more than $1 billion of oil was later discovered on those very lands. At the age of 16, Albert Lasker became a reporter on the Galveston News. He soon moved on to a better-paying position in Dallas on the Dallas Morning News, the largest newspaper in Texas. Lasker soon found that the real money in the newspaper business was not in journalism, but in advertising, which brought in most of the revenue. Lasker went to Chicago, where he talked his way into a position with Lord and Thomas, the city's largest agency. He was only 19 years old. Because he had agreed that his salary depended on how much business he could bring into the firm, he became a fanatical hustler. At the age of 25, he had saved enough money together with his family's money to buy 25% of the agency. At that time, he was earning $1,000 a week. The President of the United States was then paid $10,000 a year. Now, at the age of 30, Lasker bought the entire agency. He went on to participate in some of the most memorable advertising campaigns in the history of the advertising business. He built a $3.5 million estate in the exclusive suburb of Lake Forest Mill Road Farm, a 480-acre spread with 27 buildings and a million-dollar golf course, which Bob Jones described as one of the three best golf courses in the United States. At the age of 42, he had arrived. The estate employed 50 workers who kept 6 miles of hedges clipped each week. The French chateau in the center of all this luxury was more magnificent than anything built by his crusty neighbors, who viewed him with ill-disguised dislike. For years, he was the only Jewish resident, and he delighted in brooding it about that he intended to leave the estate in his will as a Jewish community center. Lasker was always very active in major Jewish organizations, serving on the American Jewish Committee and the powerful Anti-Defamation League. His sister, Florine, founded the National Council of Jewish Women and the Civil Liberties Committee in New York. Another sister, Etta Rosenson, was a passionate Zionist who headed the Hadassah organization. During the First World War, Lasker had been persuaded by his friend Bernard Baruch to join Woodrow Wilson's cabinet as an assistant secretary. This was to be his only government post. Despite the fact that he had built Lord and Thomas into a giant advertising agency, he felt that Chicago was too small for him, so he soon moved his headquarters to New York. When he joined the agency, it had only $900,000 a year in income, of which a third came from one product. After he moved to New York, he realized that he was in a position to launch national campaigns to sell products whose stocks would then greatly increase in value. So he cannily invested large sums in products, which had not yet gained wide public acceptance, his most notable triumph being his promotion of Kotex. The press had long had a phobia about any mention of Kotex, and it was seldom advertised. Lasker bought $1 million worth of International Cellulose, who was the manufacturer of Kotex, and then launched a tremendous campaign in newspapers and magazines. He made many millions of dollars in profits on this one operation, but not only did he change the firm for his advertising campaign, but he also reaped millions from the stock operation. He repeated this formula with other products, amassing a fortune of nearly $50 million. He later boasted that no one has taken as much money out of advertising as I have. Lasker was behind many of the nation's most successful radio shows. He auditioned Bob Hope and launched him on a 60-year career. It was Lasker who made Amos and Andy the most popular radio show in America. He hired them for Pepsodent because he said that the half of the American population who listened to the show each evening would be envisioning the white teeth flashing in those dusky countenances. The sponsor of the show was Pepsodent toothpaste. Although the program is now denigrated as offensive to American blacks, if Lasker were still alive, he would push it as the nation's most successful television show. Lasker owned the Chicago Cubs and was a heavy gambler. He was known to bet as much as $40,000 on a single golf match. He also was a hard-driving taskmaster. In the Depression year of 1931, he had a personal profit of $1 million. This did not dissuade him from cutting back the expenses of his business. He took advantage of the widespread unemployment and the Depression to hire 50 people from the staff of Lord & Thomas. Those who remained had their salaries cut by 50%. One of Lasker's most successful promotions was his campaign to popularize drinking orange juice for the Sunkist Company. He is best remembered, however, for his association with American Tobacco's George Washington Hill. When Lasker came onto the scene, Percival Hill was still the firm's president, the son of a prominent Philadelphia banker. He had built up a successful carpet business, which he sold, investing the proceeds in a tobacco company. Well, Blackwell Tobacco was the name of it. He then sold this firm to the tobacco king, James Duke. Duke reorganized the firm in 1911 and asked Hill to become president. His son, George Washington Hill, became vice president. Lasker got the account after World War I when tobacco manufacturers were very conservative in their advertising expenditures. They rarely spent large sums promoting a single brand, preferring to advertise their entire line. Lasker persuaded the Hills to concentrate their advertising and to increase their budget. He did so, and sales skyrocketed. In a single year, Lasker increased their advertising budget from $1 million to $25 million. He managed to maintain good relations with the arrogant and domineering George Washington Hill, whose crudeness was memorialized by Sidney Greenstreet in the film The Hucksters. Greenstreet portrayed Hill as a loathsome slob who made his point by spinning a great gob on the table in front of his directors. Lasker created the catchy slogan for Lucky Strikes, "It's toasted." When World War II began, he tried to foist a supposedly patriotic slogan on the American public. "Lucky Strike, Green has gone to war." The campaign was a flop. It was a flimsy pretext. The green color used in the package had been requisitioned for the war effort. Lasker's greatest achievement was his national campaign to persuade women to smoke in public. He could be said to be the father of women's lung cancer. At that time, very few women were bold enough to be seen smoking in public. But ably assisted by his minions in Hollywood, Lasker saw to it that in many scenes of movies, leading women in the movies would be seen smoking cigarettes in public. His greatest success was through Betty Davis, who delivered her lines in almost every scene through a thick cloud of smoke. Smoking in public now became common, creating a vast new market for cigarettes, which, of course, was Lasker's only goal. Some 20 years later, many of these women were dying from emphysema or from lung cancer. Let me pause here and make an observation. Lasker, more than likely, was not trying to give women cancer. He wasn't trying to do anything but make money. It's just that there is a way that seems right to a man, but the ends thereof are the ways of death. So in the process, what Lasker obtained, or what he succeeded in doing, was persuading us, through the movies, that we all ought to smoke. After all, if John Wayne and Betty Davis and Clark Gable and all of these big movie stars, you know, smoke, it must be good, it must be chic, it must be the thing to do. And so, like all good followers, and remember that 95% of people are introverts, 5% are extroverts. Lasker is an extrovert. 95% of us followed Lasker's example. His motivation? Let's make money. But in the process, take a look at what's happened to cancer in the United States. In 1900, one person out of 33 could expect to get cancer. Today, it's one person out of two, and only 10 years from now, it's expected to be as high as one out of every person in America. One out of one. 100%. Not only has the medical monopoly failed us, the advertising monopoly has succeeded in selling us the very products to cause the cancer for which you and I are then supposed to go out and march or run or donate to these cancer societies, to these cancer philanthropies. Now, if that's not genius, you know, you just tell me what is. They got us smoking to cause cancer. Then they got us running to donate money to cancer research. They control the cancer research so that if anybody accidentally or on purpose comes up with a cancer cure, we can bury it so that we can maintain a $500 billion a year industry called the cancer industry, cancer for profit. Now, that's not an accident, boys and girls. That's done on purpose. Now, Lasker's furious pays took its toll. He had three nervous breakdowns, but his greatest shock came when his wife died in 1936. So he met an actress the following year, Doris Kenyon, then impulsively married her. The marriage lasted only a few months. She went back to Hollywood, divorced him, and married the brother-in-law of pianist Arthur Rubinstein, which proved to be a successful marriage. In 1939, while lunching with Wild Bill Donovan at the 21 Club, who was soon to become head of the wartime OSS, later the CIA, he was introduced to an attractive divorcee, an art dealer named Mary Woodard, the daughter of a Wisconsin banker. Now, she had started a dress company, Hollywood Patterns, designing inexpensive dresses for working women, and then had gone into the art business. Now, a few days later, while he was lunching with publisher Richard Simon, he met her a second time and decided to marry her. He was just starting to build an art collection and knew very little about painting. He later claimed that he had married her to save $1 million in sales commissions, which he probably did do. She tried to get him to relax and soon had him going to a psychoanalyst. He was lunching with Richard Simon again when he jumped up and said, "I'm late for my psychoanalyst." Simon seemed puzzled, and Lasker explained, "I'm doing it to get rid of all the hate the advertising business has put into me." It's likely that he had put more hate in advertising business than it had put into him, despite the fact that practically all of his close friends were prominent Jews, such as Bernard Baruch, Anna Rosenberg, David Sarnoff, and the New York publicist Ben Sonnenberg, and Louis Strauss of Kuhn Loeb Company. He rarely hired Jews in his advertising firm, and when he was reproached for this, he merely smiled and said, "Look, I went into this firm and took it over. Do you think I want somebody to do that to me?" Among Lasker's protégés were very successful advertising men such as Emerson Foote, William Benton, and Fairfax Cohn, all of whom were Gentiles. Lasker liked to call them his little goyim. He joked about how he could make them jump when he barked. In 1942, Lasker, having made a large fortune, decided to close down Lord & Thomas. His protégés went on to found the firm of Fairfax Cohn & Belding. William Edward, a lawyer, had married Carla, the daughter of Bernard Gimbel of the department store fortune. At the wedding, Lasker dourly cited an old Jewish proverb, "You can't make an omelet from two spoiled eggs." He was proven right. They got a divorce. His daughter Mary married the Chicago steel tycoon Leigh Block of Inland Steel. They amassed a multi-million dollar art collection. She also became a vice president of Foote, Cohn, and Belding. Block's brother Joseph became president of the Jewish Federation. Now, Lasker had grown bored with wearing white shirts, so he started the vogue of wearing blue shirts in New York, which became the hallmark of the advertising profession. He never learned to drive a car. He had no mechanical skills. And after moving to New York, he begrudged the enormous upkeep of his Lake Forest estate. In 1939, he donated it to the University of Chicago. The trustees promptly sold it off for building lots. The million-dollar mansion went for $110,000. We're talking about Lasker, the advertising man who once headed the Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York. It's halfway time here, children. I've got to give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, for more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, non-state schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the law hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these law hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The law hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com, and you can download that free general law CD package direct from our archives page. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour an editorial review item. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Tonight's subject, The Prophets of Cancer, taken from the book Murder by Injection, put out by Eustace Mullins. Eustace Mullins is spelled E-U-S-T-A-C-E, Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S, Murder by Injection. Only one chapter in here about vaccination. The rest of it has to do about medicine and health in general, and particularly things like the drug trust, contamination of the food chain, the Rockefeller Syndicate, fluoridation, and the subject we're covering here, The Prophets of Cancer. You can probably get a copy of Murder by Injection by going to bravenewbookstore.com. Bravenewbookstore.com, I think that's your one-stop shopping headquarters for all underground books. Books that the libraries of America won't buy or keep because they run afoul of the Rockefeller interests. All right, that's bravenewbookstore.com. They're located at 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, Austin, Texas, 78705. Again, that's 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, Austin, Texas, 78705. I got a phone down there. Jot it down. It's 512-480-2503. Once more, that's area code 512-480-2503. All right, the cancer prophet, or the prophets of cancer. Lasker, who was a huckster, a number one huckster, who pushed cancer, sold the American Cancer Society. We've been going through his background. As a young man, he started out with plenty of money. And he took that plenty of money and he turned it into something even bigger than plenty of money. Lasker's importance to this narrative is the fact that he and his cohort, a patent medicine huckster named Elmer Bopps, took the American Cancer Society, which at the time was a moribund group in the early 1940s, and within months they built it into a powerful national force. They used all of their techniques for promotion, fundraising, and business organization to make this group the most powerful force in the new billion-dollar world of cancer treatment, an achievement for which the Rockefeller medical monopoly was extremely grateful. They summarily dumped a cumbersome organization known as the Woman's Army, which was very decentralized, and placed all of the power of the American Cancer Society in New York City. All of its meetings are held there. They also used their business connections to bring in a new board of trustees from the biggest names in banking and industry, charging $100,000 each for the privilege of serving on the board. Now, you'll notice here that these boards of directors are headed by the who's who of American business. Now, you want to serve on these boards, you've got to be in the money, as evidenced by this little piece of information. $100,000 is what you pay for the privilege of serving on the board of directors of the American Cancer Society. Now, after launching the American Cancer Society as a viable organization, Lasker himself became ill with cancer. He was operated on for intestinal cancer in 1950, not knowing that cutting into a cancer immediately spreads it throughout the body. He died in 1952 at the Harkness Rockefeller Pavilion. Before his death, he set up the Albert and Mary Lasker Foundation, which was to make Mary Lasker the most powerful woman in American medicine. Mary soon controlled a vast empire of grants, foundations, Washington lobbyists, and other organizations. Her most able lieutenant in achieving this power was the Rockefeller employee, Anna Rosenberg, who has worked closely with her for years. Elmer Bopst, who was Lasker's partner in putting the American Cancer Society over the top, was also a tycoon. Unlike Lasker, Bopst had to come from a poor family, but he also had the born huckster's mentality, taken from that Native American entrepreneur, P.T. Barnum, who said there's a sucker born every minute. Bopst joined the drug firm of Hoffman LaRoche in 1911, where his talents as a salesman got him the presidency of the firm. He was also a shrewd businessman. Just after World War I, knowing that commodity prices were bound to fall, he was shocked to find that the firm had accumulated huge inventories in the New Jersey warehouse. He quickly closed a deal with Eastman Kodak to buy 5 tons of bromides, a key ingredient not only of analgesics, but also of photographic supplies. He offered the bromides at 60 cents a pound, 10 cents below the market price. Within a few weeks, the market price had fallen to 16 cents a pound. Bob's great achievement at Hoffman and LaRoche was his advertising campaign for vitamins. He was so successful that he won the nickname of the Vitamin King. He made millions of dollars in the stock market, and he decided to leave Hoffman LaRoche for greener pastures. In 1944, he called in Kravath, Swain, and Moore, the lawyers for Kuhn Loeb, to negotiate his terms. They got him a very favorable settlement of $150,000 the first year and $60,000 a year until his 70th or 75th birthday. Having made his fortune in peddling vitamins, he now moved on to the higher-priced pills. Becoming head of Warner Lambert, this firm's biggest product was Listerine. Gerald Lambert, no mean huckster himself, had built Lambert Pharmacol into a giant empire, principally through his relentless warnings about the perils of bad breath. His father had invented a mouthwash for which he appropriated the most famous name in medicine, Baron Joseph Lister, the inventor of antiseptics and asepsis in hospitals. A prominent surgeon, Baron Lister, had operated on Queen Victoria herself, the only time she submitted to the knife. Gerald Lambert made his name a household word with full-page advertisements for Listerine. Banner headlines warned that even your best friend won't tell you. Lambert coined a new word for this plague, halitosis, from the Latin for bad breath. At the height of the 1920 stock market boom, Gerald Lambert sold his firm to the Warner Corporation for $25 million, the equivalent of $500 million in 1980 dollars. The deal was closed in 1928. Within a year, the value of the firm had dropped to $5 million. The resulting Warner-Lambert Corporation had shown little growth during the 1930s, so Bobst was hired primarily for his marketing skills. But he soon proved that he was an empire builder, buying more than 50 additional companies, and in an astute move, he named Albert Driscoll president of the firm. Driscoll had just served 7 years as governor of New Jersey. As directors, Bobst brought in the shrewdest brains on Wall Street, Sidney Weinberg of Goldman Sachs, Frederick Eberstadt of Eberstadt & Company, as director of public relations. He brought in Anna Rosenberg, who had long been director of labor relations for the Rockefellers, at their primary holding Rockefeller Center. This meant that Bobst now had established a key Rockefeller connection, as Anna Rosenberg continued to have a close association with her former employers. Because he was the only one who was aware of his ambitious plans, Bobst had bought heavily into Warner Lambert stock before he began his great expansion. As a result, the stock increased many times in value. He was now the largest stockholder, worth many millions. Fortune described his signature lifestyle, his vast estates in New Jersey, his 87-foot yacht at Spring Lake, and his suite at the Waldorf Astoria. In fact, Bobst owned 5 yachts in succession, each one larger than the last, and all named Elisa. The last being called Elisa V, he also married a second time, marrying the Lebanese delegate to the United Nations. He was chairman of the war bond drive in New Jersey during World War II, and he became a large contributor to political campaigns. Bobst thus became a very influential person behind the scenes, a figure to be reckoned with in the Republican Party, so much so that he chose his own man for the presidency. Eisenhower, Secretary of the Treasury, George Humphrey of the Rothschild Bank, National City Bank of Cleveland, had been slated to speak at a fundraising rally in New Jersey of which Bobst was chairman. He became ill, and Vice President Richard Nixon was sent in his place. This began a close relationship between Bobst and Nixon, which was almost a father-son relationship. Nixon was dazzled by Bobst's millionaire lifestyle, and he saw to it that the Bobsts were frequently invited to the White House dinners. In 1957, Nixon was able to introduce Bobst to the Queen of England at a White House gathering. After Nixon's ill-advised, if justified, attack on the press after his campaign in California failed, it seemed that his political career was over. However, Bobst was not about to give up on such a potential ally. Nixon later fondly recalled the best advice Bobst ever gave him. Bobst had drawn him aside during what was a period of great depression for Richard Nixon and earnestly told him, he said, "Dick, it's time you learned the facts of life. You see, there are really only two kinds of people in the world, the eaters and the eaten. You just have to make up your mind which group you want to be in." So at a time when Nixon had little or no prospects, Bobst went to his attorney, Matt Harrell, the senior partner of the Wall Street firm of Mudge Rosenstern. Warner Lambert was their biggest client, and when Bob suggested to Harrell that he bring in Nixon from California as a partner of the firm, Harrell was only too happy to oblige. With this springboard, Nixon was able to launch his successful campaign for the presidency. The move turned out to be a wise investment all around. After Nixon won the election, the Republican governors of the states of New Jersey, Nebraska, Kentucky, and West Virginia turned over all their tax-free bond business to Mudge Rose, giving the firm an additional $1 million a year of income. In January of 1971, Mudge Rose appeared before the Justice Department on the matter of the merger of Warner Lambert and Park Davis, a decision which meant millions of dollars to Bobst. Attorney General John Mitchell, also a protege of Bobst, disqualified himself. His Deputy Attorney General Richard Kleindienst then let the merger go through. These were the only deals which became a part or a matter of public record or public knowledge. No doubt there were many more. In a brilliant tax move, Mitchell advised Bobst to donate $11 million to New York University for the Bobst Library. In 1973, Bobst had his autobiography published by David McKay Company in New York, an obvious puff job. It was a glowing account of Bobst's accomplishments, unmarred by any unfavorable comments. When Bobst died in 1978, no obituary appeared in the New York Times. This was an amazing circumstance concerning one of New York's most prominent tycoons. The Times routinely memorialized even the minor executives of New York firms. Strangely enough, a public statement about Bobst did appear in the Times, a memorial eulogy by his longtime friend, Lawrence Rockefeller, the chairman of Sloan Kettering. And Rockefeller said, his efforts in the fight against cancer earned the sincere gratitude of cancer patients and researchers, as well as the general public. Perhaps Bobst's real memorial is the label of Listerine, which still carries the message, for bad breath, insect bites, infectious dandruff, 26.9% alcohol. Now, Rockefeller was referring to Bobst's revitalization of the American Cancer Society. Under his leadership, it had obtained a new charter on June 23, 1944, and it underwent a complete reorganization. The staff was expanded to 300, and the two hucksters launched a national campaign to enlist 2.5 million volunteers to patrol every foot of the nation in gathering funds to fight cancer, because the orders to engage in this campaign always came from business tycoons, social leaders, and politicians. The masses had no alternative. They had to obey. The huckster talents of Bobst and Lasker resulted in the often ludicrous spectacle of millions of peasants being herded out into the streets in an annual march to rattle tin cans and beg donations for the super rich. The only campaign to equal it probably was the annual drive by the Nazi Party in Germany for contributions for the Winter Health Campaign. The American Cancer Society campaign operated on the same business lines. The millions of volunteers threw themselves into this annual task because their jobs, their social position, their families depended on their willingness to make the sacrifice to the God of Mammon, which was presently masquerading as the ghost of cancer's past and the ghost of cancer's yet to come. Now, the chairman of the American Cancer Society, Clarence D. Little, had been named to that post in 1929 by the Rockefellers, longtime associates who had established a laboratory for him at their summer home on Mount Desert Island. He seemed to have no interest in cancer, spending most of his time as president of the American Birth Control League, the Euthanasia Society, and the Eugenics Society, the latter being a pet project of the Harriman family. Now, he admitted that in 1943, the American Cancer Society spent nothing on research. Little had been president of the University of Michigan and now served as overseer of Harvard University. Under his leadership, the cancer group had been nothing more than a small group of elitists who met occasionally in New York City. Despite its reorganization on a more business-like basis, the American Cancer Society, long after the Little's departure, continued to pile up a stunning record of non-accomplishment. One critic, a longtime federal official, publicly stated that it should be called the Infantile Society for National Paralysis. However, the Society's inability to find a cure for cancer was hardly accidental. The Bobst-Lasker influence brought it firmly into the orbit of the Sloan Kettering Institute, whose motto had long been millions for research, but not 1 cent for a cure. Charles McCabe, the irreverent columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, wrote on September the 27th, 1971, "You might be wondering if the personnel of the American Cancer Society or cancer research foundations and other sainted organizations are truly interested in a cure for cancer, or whether they would like a problem which supports them to continue to exist." Now, that's the bottom line. You see, boys and girls, they learned a lesson from the March of Dimes. The March of Dimes was a successful money-making operation, but when they discovered a vaccine for polio and then eliminated polio, the March of Dimes collapsed. The money tree died. Boys and girls, do you understand that a cure to cancer means the loss of a $500 billion a year industry? First of all, the United States economy couldn't stand that kind of a hit. A $500 billion hit like that would collapse the economy. So that's just reason number one. Number two, literally millions of people make their livings off of cancer. you know, everybody from the researchers that are looking for a cure to the oncologists that are out here cutting out your liver or cutting out your lungs or giving you some other operation, you know, those people all depend upon this. And then, you know, all the drug companies, and $500 billion a year. Show you how big that is. It's as big as all of the public education of the United States, $500 billion a year. It's as big as the entire national defense industry, $500 billion a year. They are dedicated to making sure that there is never a cure to cancer. Now, I've reported to you before that there are 14 cures to cancer. Three of them, cut, burn, and poison, actually work 37% of the time. It's the 63% of the time that they don't work that is the problem. Now, the new Bob Stalasker Board of the American Cancer Society featured the usual array of Rockefeller cohorts. Anna Rosenberg, Eric Johnson, longtime head of the Chamber of Commerce and now head of the Motion Picture Association, a public relations spokesman for the Hollywood moguls, John Adams, a partner of Lazard Fairs, the head of Standard Brands, General William Donovan, the Wall Street lawyer who was selected by the British Intelligence Service to head the new Office of Strategic Services, the nation's spy network. He was later sent to Thailand as U.S. ambassador to oversee the operations of the world dope ring. Emerson Foote, Lasker's advertising protege, Ralph Reed, the president of the American Express Company, Harry Von Elm, the super banker who was president of Manufacturers Trust, Florence Mahoney, the multi-million dollar heiress of the Cox newspaper fortune, and a longtime crony of Mary Lasker. In 1958, the officers of the American Cancer Society were Alfred P. Sloan, president, Monroe J. Rathbone, president of Standard Oil, Mrs. Anna Rosenberg Hoffman, and the Rockefeller Foundation, General Donovan, Eric Johnston, Senator Ralph Yarborough of Texas, a perennial champion of socialized medicine, established a 26-member national panel of consultants on a conquest of cancer. Hey, isn't that just special? I'll put a little mark right here in the margin. We'll take it up right there next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Remember, you can get a copy of this from Brave New Bookstore. .com. Go to bravenewbookstore.com. And you're looking for Murder by Injection by Eustace Mullins. Hey, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.